You're listening to the Black British Parent Podcast, having conversations, sharing experiences, and supporting the Black British Parent community with your host, Deborah Field Pelly.
I just want to say thank you so much for accepting my invitation to join us on this podcast. I remember a little while back, a couple of years ago, Camilla reached out to us at Black British Parent, and we started having conversations about what was happening, what happened to you, Sianda. I can honestly say that the initial conversations made me feel so different. Like, I've never felt that way before, based on what was being told to me, what story was being shared to me. And I'm not going to speak too much about it because I want you to tell your story. But again, when it's obviously one of a case of injustices as severe as yours, in terms of racial injustices and how the system, the country that we're living in, and how they approach it, please, Camilla and Sianda, thank you so much for joining us. And please tell us a bit about your story and your campaign, Free Sianda.
No, thank you so much for having us on your platform. I really appreciate it. So, where'd you start? So, Free Sianda was created by my mum, as you know, because I was the victim of a racially aggravated assault by three people. So it was two men and a woman in their 30s to 40s, whilst on a camping trip that I was invited on. So I was attacked by them, managed to get away with the help of my boyfriend, and basically the police were called. And once I saw the police, I thought that they had come to help me. So I approached the police and basically dropped into their arms, and they just put the handcuffs straight on me and arrested me for grievous bodily harm. So basically, I was arrested for causing grievous bodily harm to one of my attackers. The injury that I supposedly caused was a cut on her forehead, which didn't require, you know, stitches or surgery or anything like that. But essentially, I was sentenced to prison for it, 4.5 years, ended up served half in custody, and now doing the other half out in the community. So in total, I was in prison for 2 years and 3 months, and that started on the 13th of March 2020 and ended on the 13th of June 2022. So, you know, when I was arrested and obviously was in police custody, it was just almost surreal to even think about. Obviously, I was very injured. I had concussion. I had a lot of bruising to my face, like my neck muscles. When I went to the hospital, they said I had like whiplash from being sort of dragged around on the floor. I had bruising to my ribs, bruising on my back, bruising on my legs. So I was just in a lot of pain, and it was a really horrible experience when I was in police custody, because I basically was just in so much shock and just really didn't understand what was going on. And the worst thing is, all of the police officers that I encountered on that night, they all were like, "Don't worry, like, we're taking you away from like what happened. It's your side of the story counts as well, just because they, you know, called the police first, you know, you've got your story and we're going to investigate, we're going to help you because we can see that you're a really nice girl and we don't think that you would do this." So, yeah, that's what they said. You know, we're going to help you. And I remember when you're in police custody and they take like swabs, in your cheek and of your hands and stuff like that, and do your fingerprints. And I remember they asked me to take my bobble out, and like literally a clump of my hair just came out with the bobble, where, you know, my hair had been ripped out from being dragged by my bun bait, essentially. And I remember the female police officer who was taking my swab, she was like, oh my gosh. And I was literally like in hysterics and tears. And I really thought that they were trying to help me initially on the night when it happened. So I went to sleep, woke up in the morning, and that's really when everything sort of changed. I was actually in police custody for 20 hours. 18 of those hours, I wasn't allowed to have a shower or anything like that. And the thing is, in all of the assault, I essentially like wet myself. So I was basically sat in like, you know, sort of soaked underwear and clothes. And the only thing that I could think of to make me feel slightly better was a shower. And like, I couldn't even have that. And I mean, it's so minor when, you know, it, compared to the whole enormity of my situation. But yeah, I really remember that. It really was horrible. So we tried, after I was released, I was on bail for about 6 months.
Yeah, I think it was until the August.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember me and Mum were just reaching out to anyone that we could or anyone that we found online, just trying to get help because, you know, we're not from a life where we have interaction with the police or we don't know anyone that's been in police custody. We don't know. So we were completely blind. And when we were in Wales as well, we didn't have much of like a support network. You know, there was no black community where we lived. So we couldn't even turn to anyone like that. We didn't know what to do.
I mean, the organisation was there from the beginning. I found them in the beginning. I found them in the gym. The monitoring group.
Okay.
So I found them from the beginning, days after. But they're not based locally. Okay. So when Sianda was saying that we was trying to find people, yeah, we found people, but you know, they weren't able to kind of give us that direct help that we needed, because I think, you know, it was very apparent days, 24, 48 hours later, that the police weren't going to help us. It was apparent. It was very apparent, because no one came to interview Sianda as a victim.
Although they did actually refer me to victim support, and I have my own crime reference number for the crime, which sits... What?
In statistics, obviously, because that's all they do it for.
Yeah,
so they don't do anything with it. They do it to try and make out that they report these crimes.
Yeah, so it sits in statistics, an unsolved case, basically. And yeah, it was referred to victim support, which was like the most useless service I've ever encountered. You know, they assigned me a victim support officer. Who was from a different police force because of the area that I live in and the area that it happened in. So they assigned me a victim support officer and everything, but then were basically saying that I wasn't a victim, I was the perpetrator. So it was all very confusing. But yeah, as my mum said, it became apparent to me the next morning when I was still in police custody that you know, they weren't going to help me. And then it got even worse in the coming days. So we did everything that we could do. You know, we sent them pictures, we sent them everything that we had that basically proved, you know, that I had been attacked. And essentially in the trial, it was basically found that the investigating officer failed to provide crucial evidence to the CPS. And
but you send them pictures, they had all the evidence and they had not enough evidence, or he didn't submit evidence, you're saying?
So we sent a total of, was it five pictures?
Six pictures.
And the most important picture, which was of the footprint on my face, the imprint, it didn't somehow get sent to the CPS. And if anyone's seen the picture of the footprint, which is on my campaign website and came out of the appeal, it's it's quite clearly a footprint. So
very clear.
So yeah, so and their excuse for that was that they thought it was a duplicate picture, and that sometimes they have firewall issues, so they might not have actually received it, which is ridiculous because they received all of the others. And you know, they were challenged in court as to why they're like, you know, did you actually investigate Sianda's side of the story? And they outright said no. And when Seth asked, why didn't you investigate? They said, because my supervisor told me not to. So then when my defense team said, okay, so who's your supervisor then? Who told you not to? We want to know so that we can, you know, question them. He said, I don't know their name. And just that small snippet alone, you would think would be enough for a jury to say, okay, there's, you know, there's reasonable doubt here, you know, things weren't carried out properly. But it's even shocking when I say it to believe that that alone didn't stop that trial. The judge allowed that to happen as if, you know, well, that's fine. That's an acceptable answer from a police officer, you know, whatever. And obviously there's a lot of things I can't disclose and discuss, but that's just funny. Know that there were many moments like that in the trial, which really shows, I mean, obviously I, you know, was in a really bad place with my mental health, PTSD from the assault, worry that I was going to go to prison. But I tell you what, halfway through that week, in my head, as much as I still was anxious, I genuinely didn't think I was going to prison. So much so that we never even thought about packing a bag.
No, because the reason why we thought that is because the trial was a circus. It was an absolute circus, you know. One side saying that Sianda was the aggressor. We're saying that, no, Sianda got beaten, because their side is that Sianda was the aggressor and ran. Ran where? When she just come out of post-surgery 8 weeks of a reconstructed legs surgery.
Okay, so there's loads of questions running through my mind, but I just wanted to flow through what you're saying, and I didn't want to interject too much, and I can interject a bit too much sometimes. So, yeah. And I'm trying to be mindful of as well, because obviously this is something that happened to you, both of you. It happened to you, Sianda, and as mum, Camilla, this is what you experienced and your baby going through. I can't imagine what that must feel like for you. Like, my children have had really not obviously as major situations, and I know how I feel when those things happen to my children. So you live in Wales. This happened in Wales?
Yeah.
Right? In a different part to where you normally reside, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, more like mid-Wales.
Okay. And you was on a trip with your boyfriend and some friends? Okay, you can't say fine.
No, it was she was invited by her boyfriend's family. Yeah, so that camping trip had already been organised by her boyfriend's family's friends. So okay. They were invited, and then the parents invited Sianda and her partner. So they went along separately. So it wasn't an altogether, because there's stories out there that it was a group of 15 people. No, Sianda and her partner went separately. It was already an event that was organised by them. Yeah, so she and her partner was invited as a guest. They only intended to stay one night, and that one night cost her. so that's what it is. But because it is out there that she was with a group of friends, Sianda was with people, a lot of people that she didn't know. She knew the parents, and that was about it. So, you know, that's what the situation was. That's how that situation came about, how she went to the camping trip.
Okay. Were there any other Black people on that trip?
There was no other Black people. There was no other Black people.
Not in that part of people. Okay. And the incident that happened that you unfortunately had to experience, it was within that party that you was staying with that were the perpetrators, is what I'm getting at. The perpetrators were within that party that you was with, that group of people you was with.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't understand how this has happened. I don't understand
The thing is, one thing that my current solicitor has said to me from the start is, to me, to us three, it makes no sense. It's like, how can this have happened? You know, there's so many flaws. But one thing that my current solicitor has always said to me is, you can never, ever apply common sense to the law, ever. And I think anyone that has been in the clutches of the criminal justice system, you know, anyone who has dealt with the police, we all know or will know that the way that they do things, it makes no sense. There are laws, there are regulations, there are things that they can do, which in itself are criminal, but they're allowed to do it in the name of justice. So no, it doesn't make sense.
Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, it doesn't make sense. But honestly, if once the whole truth is able to be revealed, it will blow your mind even more, because that is the reality that I'm living in. Literally, something that makes absolutely no sense has been allowed to happen, and my life will be affected as a result.
I mean, whilst on this trip, you were recovering from surgery. What was that surgery for? I mean, you've said it before, but please remind me.
So I had basically had both my legs reconstructed. I have a condition, I have hypermobility. So I've suffered with issues with my knees and legs for, you know, a long time. So I finally had the first reconstruction of my left leg. Was it my right leg or my left leg?
I think it was your left.
Yeah, sorry.
That means your legs are fine now.
No, they're not fine now. Not at all. I wish. So the reconstruction was just the first part. And then there was a lot of metal plates in my legs. So they have to be removed. But of course, because I was sent to prison, I never got them removed. I mean, I know COVID happened as well, so it probably would have taken longer still. But yeah, I still haven't had those removed now, 3 years on, which is causing difficulties.
As you can see, I'm actually speechless. I like I said, I've spoken to your mum when your mum first contacted us, and the story, we have people contacting us about all sorts of things, and it's very difficult to do to you. It's not for me to judge whose is more important than whose isn't, or who's telling the truth, or whose side. I can't do any of that. So my first port of call is to ask for more information. And the story, what your mum was passing on to me, was just the little bit that I you was able to share with me at the time, Camilla, was just, I needed straight away. I said, you need to come on live and come and explain. If it, not explain, but come and talk and share your story with the rest of our community, if you are able to. Do you know what I mean? And yeah, it's really, like, even now, I'm still mindful, because I don't want it to be seen like I'm exploiting or using anyone's story. But this is what people need to hear and understand. And even while I'm trying to understand it for myself, as you know, and I don't understand how things like this can happen like this. And I feel like...
It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense because... You know, I think when we were speaking on your live, I was explaining her disabilities. I was explaining their version of events. You know, two 40-year-old men and a 30-year-old woman. A 20-year-old black woman is not going to be approaching them in any aggressive manner in that situation on a camping site. It's not happening. It's not happening.
Let alone in the condition that she's in. Exactly. Sorry, I didn't speak here. You're not here, but that it's... Exactly. The stories that have gone on afterwards to say, I mean, I know you know this already, so I hope, forgive me for repeating it, but just the fact that they're saying that you try to run away after that, like all of these little things, it just doesn't make any sense. So, okay.
I have not been able to run 4 years. I wish. The amount of trains I used to miss when I went to college, the amount of buses I would miss, I have not been able to run for years. So I would have loved to see it happen. Yeah. It just would never have happened. I remember being told that obviously when I was inside, and yeah, it just made me laugh because it run where?
Yeah, run where? You know, anyone that's had any kind of leg surgery, 8 weeks post-op, you're not running anywhere, especially if you've got a load of metal holding your knee joint together. You are not running anywhere at 8 weeks. you're not. And it was the first time, or I think the second time, Sianda had ventured out since her post-op anyway, since that operation anyway. Because she was in a splint. She had come out the splint days before. So when we presented all of that in court, in trial, for me, I think from what I can remember when I was explaining to you, I was trying to get across how, the jury heard that and didn't want to put their common sense together and say, hold on, this just does not sound right. Do you know what I mean? And, proof had been provided of the operation. Proof had been provided of her history. Pictures, rolls of pictures. So, we ended up bringing more than the 6 pictures that I sent to the police to court to show. Look, these are how the bruises developed over a period of weeks. We had a dossier that the CPS didn't have, because obviously after the 6 photos and the police telling me to go jump, we never sent the rest. So, this is the reason why we thought, okay, we've got some kind of chance here, because we saw the CPS barrister in himself when he saw the rest of the pictures and my timestamps on those pictures. So you couldn't deny that they were from that period. Do you know what I mean? He was looking at the picture and he was shaking. He said, all those actions we saw, made us feel, there's no way she would be found guilty of that, because the stories just don't add up. Do you know what I mean? So the whole situation is bullshit. And as Sianda said, when you go, if you're unfortunate enough to be caught in such a situation, when you're black, it's bullshit. Huh. You are not taken care of as a victim. You are looked at as the aggressor, no matter how impossible it would look in common sense and people with sense, because it's the police you're dealing with. And then you're having a bunch of white people saying, that black girl did it, that black girl did it. Do you know what I mean? Then you got no chance, no matter what proof you pass over. When the police aren't interested, it goes downhill. It goes downhill from there.
Well, how does... I don't know, as a mom, how does this make you feel, having going through this with your daughter? How did it, how did you first find out about what happened to Sianda? And what was that like for you at the time?
I got a call from Sianda at 2 o'clock in the morning from the police station. And when she was telling me, all I remember is just screaming as she was telling me. She didn't go through everything. She just gave it in a nutshell, and that was horrific enough. And I was trying to, after speaking to her, I managed to speak to her several times before I collected her from custody over the phone. And following that telephone call, I called the police, saying, I need to go and see her. I need to know what's going on. They wouldn't tell me the location because they says, well, we don't want you to bring your gang down there.
What?
Yeah. All these things, and you don't process them at the time because of,
You're dealing with what you're doing. Yeah. Trying to get to your daughter.
Yeah. And things. And yeah, it was horrific. I felt I was angry, obviously, as a mother, as a natural protective mother of her children, knowing that adults did this. I couldn't, I can't tell you the amount of emotions and feelings I was feeling at that time, knowing the type of parent I am anyway. And I felt helpless because I was battling a system that I'm not familiar with. And I was unfamiliar. I was aware, but unfamiliar of the tricks that they use to frig you over, to stop you from gaining the answers you need to help your child, you know. There was a sense of helplessness as well. A sense of fearing if I do certain things, I might make things worse. You know, when I find advice and things like that, you know, having to rely on them and still not computing and being able to digest fully, you know, the situation, even though I knew the severity of the situation, it was very difficult to compute in legal terms what that meant or, you know, where else I could go to seek these answers. It was a horrible situation and a very difficult situation to navigate because there wasn't enough, I couldn't find enough support to be able to get what I needed for my child to help her, you know, be investigated as a victim from the very beginning. So this situation was left to drag until August when she was charged, and no one, and obviously we knew by then they wanted her head. So yeah, I was helpless. I felt helpless. I didn't feel what I was contributing was aiding my daughter's situation. You know, I was just helpless, really. And once charged, we was in the hands of the legal team. And even then, I felt helpless because I knew this wasn't right, and I knew there were inconsistencies. But it was finding the right questions to ask to be able to get the answers I need, so I could take action because I knew the legal action wasn't enough.
Yeah. Okay, so you was arrested when in 2019, the August?
I was arrested on the 25th of May, stayed 20 hours in police custody, was released on bail. Then I was formally charged in August of 2019. Okay. And then the trial happened in February 2020. Okay. And I was sent to prison on the 13th of March 2020.
13th of March 2020. At the time, I think, when they charged you? In August?
No, so I was on bail, so I didn't get remanded or anything. Okay. I literally, I was out, so, I was charged in August, but I was still out on bail.
Okay, cool.
All the court proceedings and everything. I, you know, went to court, came home, sort of thing. Went to the trial for a week in February. Even after the guilty verdict, I was sent home on bail for 3 weeks.
Okay.
And then I was sentenced and then went to prison. So even to that that part there, so when I was, what I was convicted of was grievous bodily harm with intent. So that's one under manslaughter. Now, you heard what my mum said about when we brought out these pictures and, you know, the medical evidence.
That's what I was thinking when you were just saying that. Yeah, sorry, go on.
The CPS was shaking and, you know, the CPS was scared. When that guilty verdict came in, I looked at the judge's face, his mouth dropped. The CPS barrister, he was shocked. And then, you know, and how you can know that someone is not guilty of something, then be found guilty and you can still smile about it, is disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting.
You were smiling?
CPS?
The CPS barrister. So you're shocked because you never thought... You knew I was a guilty, so you never thought that it was going to get a guilty. And when I then got the guilty, you were able to be shocked and then smile about it. these are the people that we're dealing with, basically. These are the people who are upholding the law. So even after that, with that charge, you should be remanded straight away. But they knew I wasn't guilty, and he allowed me 3 weeks to, you know, sort out my job, sort out my life, you know, any finances, anything like that. Say good, you know, say my goodbyes to my family and my friends and spend time with them. So, and this is what blows my mind. We live in a world where a system who supposedly imposes justice can still give people punishment when they know for a fact that they didn't do it. Obviously, the people in the jury are just 12 random people from the street. They don't know nothing.
White people. They don't know nothing.
We don't know nothing about law. You've got people who have been in the profession for 10, 15 years who can see through something straight away. They know. But yet the system that we have, that what those people can't don't stand up and say, actually, this is a joke. Like, why are we here? We've got a judge who's supposed to be the person, you know, in charge of the whole proceedings and, you know, with the most power. The judge has no power over the CPS. The judge works for the CPS. The CPS runs the judge. And that's what, unless you've ever been in a situation or been in a courtroom, you don't even realise it. The judge works for the CPS.
They're there to protect the crown. That's it. And they will not override, you know, if you are a defendant and you, and especially a black defendant, you know, the judge is always going to side with the prosecution, naturally. They're always going to side with that unless there's, you know, overwhelming, cannot deny, you know, kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? But unfortunately, in a situation where it's black people and you have to deal with a white jury, you know, who doesn't see their own children getting battered and beaten by adults, that don't see their own family members, that already has that bias there, and they either realise it or don't realise it, you're done for, you know. Because like I said, we saw those reactions of the judge, of the CPS. We saw those reactions when that guilty verdict come down. And, you know, when the jury was asked what the verdict was, before the usher even finished the sentence, they said guilty. Before they finished the sentence of the charge, what do you find, you know, how do you find? Before the sentence was finished, that white foreman said guilty. That's how quick, you know, they wanted to send her down. And the reaction was shocking because everyone was shocked. Everyone was shocked, prosecution, judge, everything. And, you know, we were always told by the legal team, if you get convicted of GBH with intent, you're going straight to prison, straight. So when the judge said 3 weeks bail, that was then shocking. And then it was unbelievable. What, you're trying to give compassion now? You know, ask any legal person, if you get sentenced with GBH with intent, do you go home on bail first?
That's exactly what I'm thinking. I was about to say, you can't make sense of nonsense.
No, it's all of it is nonsense. The system it does not make common sense. The law is not common sense.
And I think one of the worst things as well is that when we went for sentencing, I provided character references from my work, because I'm still employed by my job. They knew everything that was happening. They fully supported me. They actually witnessed the whole trial because I worked for public services. So they actually came to the trial and witnessed it for themselves and saw the show. They supported me fully. And I had my references and stuff. And, you know, the judge said to me, he said, so I've read your pre-sentence report and I've looked at all of your references, employment references, character references. And he said, I don't think I've ever seen such good references and such good things said about a defendant. Which shows, you know, and I can also see from your pre-sentence report that you've been through a lot and you've dealt with a lot in life, but you've always come back and you've always, you know, come back better. And he was like, so because of that, I've got no sort of, what was the word?
Basically,
because of that, I know that you will come back from this. You will come back from this sentence.
What are you telling me?
Yeah, because you've done it before, basically. I know that you will do it again. So that I am sentencing you to 4.5 years.
Yeah.
And I have to laugh because, you know, at first you think, I remember at first I thought, nah, do you know what? Like, that judge, he did me a favour. Like, he could see that I was a good person. And because that's how they make you feel, like, oh, yeah, I think, yeah, he did me a solid. But you know, when you actually, like, think about it, I'm like, excuse me.
Hold on a minute. Dwayne just asked a question. Is there minimum sentences for certain crimes? Is there minimum sentences for certain crimes?
This is the thing. So I don't know if Sandra knew this. So for GBH with intent, the minimum sentence is 5 years to life. So the minimum sentence is 5. The maximum is life. And the judge gave a 4.5.
Because he had to abide by what the
I think he wanted to be seen to be compassionate. So, you know, if we ever wanted
to... There's no compassion with sending someone to jail for defending themselves. And there's evidence to prove it in the court. Like, no, whatever, I want you guys to speak as much as possible, but I'm just sitting there just bending up my face. With, I'm looking at myself, looking all ugly and all sorts. And I'm just like, I can't understand. I don't understand. It's not I'm totally speechless, and I shouldn't be, because I know... what this is, we know what this is. Yeah. Do you see what I'm saying to you? I think what it is that it's disturbing me that this has happened. It's happened. It doesn't matter who it's happened to, it's happened, and it shouldn't be happening. Siendo, one of the questions I wanted to make sure, because I feel like we've talked a lot of what's happened, and I've been able to ask your mum how she felt about this, and I'm almost very scared to ask you, but I need to ask you that. How was this experience for you? Do you get what I mean? Just the whole being a victim of a survivor of such racial physical abuse, and then being punished for it when you defend yourself. What is that like for you? And then having to be incarcerated. I hope you understand what I'm trying to ask. I can't comprehend.
I get it. It's a heavy question, because there's so many different emotions tied to it. But in the days and weeks after what happened, that attack, I have never hated myself so much. I have never wanted so much to just no one to see me. I hated myself. I hated being black. I hated everything that distinguished me as a black woman. I felt embarrassed. I felt ashamed. I felt just this overwhelming sense of just despair. And when I think back, I think, why did you feel so embarrassed? Like, why did you feel so ashamed? And even now, I can't verbalize it. I just know that's how I felt. You know, and then I was just numb for a while, and just sat in this despair. And then going into prison, it was a bit of a weight off my shoulders, because yeah, it was the wrong thing that happened. But you know what? At least there was a next step. I wasn't just sat in limbo waiting to see what was going to happen. And then when inside, the first few months were bad, really bad. Some really dark, horrendous times, because I was on a lot of mental health medication, right, to like help me sleep, just to get through the day. And as soon as I went into prison, they took it all off me, said, you can't have it. And then didn't actually assess my mental health until about 3 months later, when I was literally on the floor begging them, like, please help me. And of course it was COVID as well. So I'm sure you've heard what the ban was like, 23 hours locked in the cell. Well, the first 2 weeks, he basically was in the cell 24 hours a day, you know, couldn't shower for a week in that tiny space with someone else who's also, you know, dealing with whatever, whilst I'm trying to adjust to being in prison. And then, things did lift in terms of, I still felt the same about my situation. I still suffered with PTSD. I still do suffer with PTSD. But I met a couple of people along the way and they really saved me. Like, they really did. And I'm so blessed to have met them, and they're still in my life now, and I'm so grateful for them. But they helped me see, that I could flip the journey on its head, in a sense. And they made me realize that I had a good life. You know, I had a good life regardless of where I was in the situation that I was in. I had a loving family that was around me. And I just practiced gratitude for that, for everything that I did have, and still felt sad and had, you know, horrendous moments, you know, just in being in prison and the oppression of that, the racism and all of that. So still had, you know, down days and down moments, but it just, every day said to myself, I'm so grateful for my family. I'm so grateful for what I do have. And that literally kept me going, like, the whole time. And then I remember the appeal happened, and I didn't know what date it was going to happen. I asked not to be told. I didn't want to be waiting for a date. And when I found out, you know, I wasn't coming home, I don't know what happened, but you just go into survival mode, and it's like a switch just flicked, and every emotion, it was done, because I can't deal with that right now. So I just, looking back, did the rest of my sentence basically just in a numb state, saying to myself, you know, like, I'm happy with my life, but not happy with my situation, tried to make the best out of everything. But now, being out, it's a lot that I have to deal with, a lot. And yeah, I'm nowhere near dealing with them. The trauma is heavy. The way it makes me feel is heavy on my heart. But again, I just try and stay grateful for what I have got. And I've got an amazing family and support system around me. And yeah, I don't know where I'm at, to be honest. It's a difficult one.
You are in a very special place, Yanda, and I can't tell you what that is, but it is a very special one, a very unique one. And thank you so much for being so honest and sharing your thoughts and feelings and your experiences. Are you getting support now through your experiences and how you're dealing with it now? Are you able to get some help with that?
I'm getting support from, like, family and friends.
It's important to know that things happen. I don't like having this cliche of things happen for a reason, but the reality is that you had an experience and now it's been brought to surface, isn't it? So it's so unfortunate that it's had to be you be the vessel of that experience. Do you know what I mean? But I would not have known anything about this. The people who are supporting you now, because I know you're getting a lot of support. I've seen your mum do so much work over the last few years, and I wish I could have helped more, but I did what I could.
You did enough, Debbie, honestly. What you did for me there, helping me to share that story on a platform, it helped, because Yanda got that support, you know, and you was part of that, and I cannot thank you enough.
That wasn't a trigger for you to do that, but I appreciate that, but I really wish I could help. You don't understand, like, so that for me, I'm going back into personal stuff again. I'm not supposed to. Anyway, it's so unprofessional. What I wanted to, I guess,
it's lessons to be learned, and there's a lot of work that we in our society need to do. And I think it's like a kick in the teeth when people say that there's no racism in this country. Do you know what I mean? And when people refer to Black experience, like when we talk too much about the Black experience, or when we're always bringing out the race card, that people, but this is why we're always talking about it. We can't stop talking about it. As long as things are happening like this and innocent people are being punished for something that they're a victim of, there's many other scenarios that this, things like this happens. I find it really difficult to see people in a vulnerable position be treated a certain way. Do you see what I mean? It's not just because you're Black, but you being Black has a huge deal with it. You might not have, whatever complexion, whatever skin, whatever culture you come from, the fact is that you are, and at the time was very much a vulnerable person. You was post-surgery, and these people don't have any empathy, any sympathy for a young Black woman who, in this case, in this instance, is very much clearly was a victim at the time. And these things, I don't want to speak too negatively about how these things can impact us, but I'd like people to really consider how these things impact us. I know people who have very bigoted and racist mindsets, have really racist mindsets, or that kind of way of thinking. This isn't for them. Do you get what I'm saying? This isn't to educate these people or anyone who wants to enable that kind of mindset. It's for us to know that this stuff is real and it happens, and we can't let this keep on happening to our people. Yeah. You know, just as any other culture wouldn't allow it to happen. And there's so much more I really want to ask you and speak with you about. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. So again, thank you so much. We're definitely going to have you come and join us again, where we can speak more about what's happening. But please, before we end, tell us about where your campaign is at the moment as we speak.
So anyone who follows the Insta will know that I did a post start of October, basically just saying that I was going to take some time out just from social media and stuff like that. So I've done that. And to be honest, I'll probably keep doing that in the future, maybe 3 months on, a couple months off, because I'm just, you know, healing isn't linear. But with the campaign, we're working on it. There's a lot that we need to do, but there's also a lot that we can't do because the system won't give us what we need.
Yeah. So we're preparing for the Supreme Court. I think your next stage of this is to hear the bombshell, what happened in the appeal court. So we're taking the things that were agreed upon in the appeal court, which is a positive, but still wasn't enough to set her free. That is, I suppose, another story. However, we're adding to that, we're doing the police's job, basically. We're doing our own investigations. We're doing our own, you know, questioning. We're doing our own things to pull together our dossier, our report to submit to the Supreme Court. However, it does take time because, as Sianda said, you know, the justice system doesn't want to deliver justice. So, you know, we have to find our ways to get what we need from them to prove beyond doubt that those appeal judges, you know, can't deny overturning her conviction. So that's what we're working on.
But basically we're healing and we're spending time together, catching up on lost time. Mm. But essentially we're coming for everyone.
Yeah. this ain't over. Far.
What can we do? What can the people do? What can the community do to help with what is happening now?
The next stage for us, what came out of the appeal court, the police should be doing something about that. Yeah. We proved perjury in the court. We proved perjury in that appeal court. We proved that those people committed perjury and the police are sat on there. You know, they don't want to do anything. So the next stage, while we're preparing for the Supreme Court, the next stage, I need to put pressure on Dovey Parish Police. They need to do something. So I'm trying to prepare what that looks like. in order to then submit to everybody if they're able to support us in getting that, because I've done it behind the scenes and I've publicly shown the response from the police commissioner from Dovey Post Police, his pathetic response. However, I'm trying to drum that up because, you know, a crime's being committed now and it's in black and white and it's against the trial and they're not doing anything. So that's my next stage, really, going forward as we're trying to submit to go to the Supreme Court.
Thank you so much, Camilla, for explaining that for us. That's a lot. That's a lot to take in. That is happening, you're having to experience. So forgive me and my ignorance and my naiveties and not fully understanding and re-asking questions. Gosh.
Yeah, it's a lot. It is a lot. It's, you know, it isn't. I think we had an hour when we spoke and you allowed me to speak a lot, which is why I could probably get from beginning to end out very quickly. And then it was processing everything after that. But yeah, it's like most injustices, you know, they've been made complicated because of the judicial system and the state. It is rooted in racism. It's rooted in white supremacy. And this is why, you know, to you and I, when we see an injustice, it's so simple. You look at it, you compute it with your knowledge and common sense. Yeah. And you can see. But the justice system complicates that deliberately, and you know, and that's what it is, and that's why, like you said, I'm glad you do platforms like this so Black people can see what we go through and what happens, and hopefully, you know, if they unfortunately come across that they're in these types of situations, at least then, you know, people like us who've been through it, they will find more support. Do you know what I mean? And things, because that's what we didn't have. That's what we couldn't find. And, you know, we hope to be one of those support networks for people that need help, so we can guide them in the right places. People can put that, you know, that can help them right there and then, you know, so for it not to become like what Siander's case has become like.
I appreciate your strength. I'm really reluctant to talk about Black women and their strength for obvious reasons, because we're always expected to be strong. But in this, you guys, you both of you, mum and daughter, have really, and your family, you know, kudos to your family and your closer network of supporters. They've been there for you, because, guys, it's such mad, unfortunate circumstances that we're having this connection with. You're both very lovely people, in my experience. Short time, a few times talking and seeing you guys. Before we go, I want to say, I want to ask you a question. Is there any advice or anything you want to share with Black British parents, should they be in a situation similar to this, or anything you think they should know?
Do you want to answer?
There's just so many things I could say, but I don't even know.
For me, if you're in a situation, I think people, you know, a lot of Black people know this anyway. You know, if you are in a situation with the police, don't trust them one bit. Don't tell them anything. Don't tell them anything. Find a good, you know, legal team, you know, that knows, that will have an understanding about these issues. You know, don't give the police an inch. They have to prove you guilty. Don't give them an inch. Don't tell them nothing. Do you know what I mean? Stay calm, stay silent. You know, that's the first instance if you were ever, you know, caught up in an arrest or anything similar. What about you, Sue?
I'm so sorry. I can't even think. My mind just went blank. You asked that question. Things just went round in my head. I'm just like... Yeah,
but you've got so many things that you probably want to say that you can't say. So do you know what? We'll leave it till the next time we arrange. I hope you, thank you again so much for joining me. And guys, please go and follow Free Siander on Instagram. You'll be updated with all the information. And I'm sure there's plenty other information in the bio that you can, if you want to know more about what is happening with Siander. And please don't bombard with too many messages as well, because as we know, you know, they got a lot that's happening right now, but showing your support is definitely plenty and enough right now, because that's what Sienda and her mum Camilla really, really need and can do with, especially in what they're having to experience at the moment. Again, thank you so much for joining us.
That's this week's episode of the Black British Parent Podcast. Be sure to go to blackbritishparent.co.uk to join the conversation. Thanks for listening. Until the next time.